Well, welcome everyone to the second day of the Morgan Stanley European Financials Conference. As Ashik was saying, I am joined today by Andrea Orcel, UniCredit CEO. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
I have a lot of questions I want to ask you, but we're going to start asking you all a question, particularly on a subject that I know has been on a lot of our minds. If you grab your handset, we'll give you 10 seconds to answer. How do you think UniCredit should deploy the excess capital? One, distribute the excess capital gradually, including by increasing the cash dividend proportion. Two, invest more in rebuilding in-house product factories and other areas that strengthen fee generation. Three, domestic M&A in Italy to increase their market share. Or four, a combination of returning through distribution and smaller bolt-on M&A. We'll give you 10 seconds. Well, there you go. There's a lot of opinion everywhere, but we have the majority on number four, a combination of returning through distribution and smaller bolt-on M&A. Now we're going to hear it directly from you. So let's kickstart. It's been over 3 years since you presented the UniCredit Unlocked plan, and you've over-delivered on key targets for the plan. UniCredit has evolved, and we're looking at a new phase. What are your key priorities and hopes moving forward?
Well, obviously, I'm very, very proud of what the team has achieved in these 3 years. At the end of the day, nobody believed in Unlocked, or very few people did. But we managed to transform the bank, multiply our net profit by 3 times vis-a-vis run rate 17-19, multiply our return on tangible by 3 times, actually 4 times if you take out the excess capital, and generate $27 billion of capital. When we started, our market cap was 17.5. We distributed our market cap. So that's what the market sees, and we're very proud of that, don't misunderstand me. But what the market sees less is that during this period that was propelled by rates, we built lines of defense and invested. Lines of defense for us were the extra provision of in excess of $2 billion that we put together in the last 3 years that we will release gradually in the future. It is the integration cost that we took, expensing them year after year, $1.1 billion just last year, and that will allow us to have a buffer for the future, but also to take cost down. It's all the cost reduction we've done, and the market sees $300 million of cost reduction. We did $1.2 billion and reinvested $900 million in factories, in digital, in frontline boosting of people and digital platform. So all of these things prepare us for what is coming next. And what is coming next for us is same game, same unlocking, different levers. We're going to defend the leadership we achieved in cost of risk, and in capital efficiency. But we're moving up in the P&L and try to create more growth or more earnings resiliency in that part, and we can talk about that later. So while for us, it's very premature to review guidance and tell you more about it. Let's see what this year does. But I can tell you that I and the management team are absolutely determined to beat and exceed 2023 in 2024 and then build greater profitability from there. And that's why we leave no stone unturned going forward. That's why we're all excited about this year, because for once, I think we will start seeing the difference between beta driven by rates and alpha driven by plans and transformation that banks have done.
And precisely touching on that, we can't think about everything that you've done so far without the context of we've been enjoying a higher rates environment. But if we think about what's next with potential rate cuts, maybe we'll be looking or moving into a neutral rate world. And we have to think about the sustainability of that profitability and, very importantly as well, the sustainability of shareholder distributions. How do you see that for UniCredit?
So for us, we've been discussing this for 2 years, and we've been looking at rates like Red Bull on the rest of the P&L and trying to prepare for what came next. And therefore, that's why we were talking about cost when nobody was talking about cost. We're going to see what cost does with inflation now. We were talking about cost of risk and other things. But if I look at the P&L, for us, what counts is profitability, 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 and net profit, and then distribution, obviously. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that, we have, if you start from the bottom end of the P&L, we have $1.4 billion in integration cost and systemic charges that we had in the net profit, expensed in the net profit of 2023, that are going to run to zero in by 25, maybe even by 24. So that's buffer number one. Secondly, as I said before, we have in excess of $2 billion of excess provision on our P&L. Either the bad cycle comes and we use them, or it doesn't and we release them. But one way or the other, either our cost of risk is flattened, or and others do not have that, or we release that $2 billion. So the first one is a perpetuity, the $1.4 billion. The $2 billion is a one-off, and when they're gone, they're gone. But still, they support our P&L for the next 2 to 3 years. The third point is cost of risk. So because of all the provision we've made in ordinary provisions, we and the discipline we've taken on our NII, we now have a cost of risk that is well below 20 basis points. It used to be 40 to 50. And we are absolutely confident we can keep it within 20 to 25 through the cycle because of the overlays, but also because if you look at our expected loss, it keeps on declining as the discipline is pervasive in the network. So that will remain flat or stay more or less at the level of today. Then you go down and up in the P&L and you start touching the revenues and you start touching fees. And we have articulated before in other occasion, how we're going to deliver $1.4 billion of excess fees. That's 20% of the fees that we generate today by 2026. And that means that a bank that was 20-25% of revenues in fees that closed 23 with 32% is going to close 24 with 35%, and post-adjustment it's going to be at 40% or above. That's a complete transformation of your top line with a complete rise in fees that is going to offset. And our fees are much more diversified than most because they're not only asset management and insurance, they're also payments, and they're also corporate solutions. And then you get up to the NII part, and that is, in my opinion, a preconceived idea. UniCredit has not been one of the rate-sensitive banks intended as has benefited the most. If you look at the numbers from 2020 to today, we benefit from our NII increased 50%. If you look our Italian peers, 100. If you look our European peer, 50. So there is no reason why on the way down we're not more aligned with our European peers given our diversification into Europe and not with our Italian peers who benefited double. So if you take into consideration all of that, you will have an NII that will come down, but it will be a high-quality NII, i.e. an NII that net of cost of risk will not be volatile and will exceed the cost of equity by a margin. And the gap is complemented by the fees, and what is not complemented, all the other buffers come into play. So that's why we're confident that if you take a three-year period, but also if you take 2024, we're going to get the job done.
I want to go deeper with that whole theme on fees because, as you pointed out, we might be looking at NII pressures when rate cuts begin. But thinking about fees, you've pointed out UniCredit has a diversified stream where you source revenues from. So where exactly do you see more potential for future fee growth? And if I may have follow up on that, you talked about the change in the way of fees as a percentage of total revenues. What would be your target moving forward for fee generation?
So I will maybe touch one point because we never touch it. I mean, we're a bank. We're a lender. So the reason why people don't like NII in general in banks is the following: loan losses, volatility, and usually people deploy on volume, not on profitability. Now, if you start taking loan losses and you bracket them and you take them low, your volatility of NII net of loan loss provision is gone. Now it's a much more sustainable thing. The second thing, if you spend all your time targeting the right clients and the right areas and having an NII that exceeds your cost of equity, then, if I may, net of cost of risk, you have a source of revenue that is more stable than fees, as we have seen in the last 3 years. Now, moving to fees, where does it come from? Well, in asset management, we are expecting adding about $400 million in revenues between now and 2026, and they come through two sources. One, as rates come down and investment move from assets under custody into assets under management, there's a market effect. I would say that everybody's going to have that, especially in Italy. What we are going to have that others don't have is the continuous clawback on the value chain, meaning usually you share part of your fees in asset management with the manufacturer. In our case, it can be a variety of them, right? When we started, we were a strict path through, no action in the middle, and we took the prices that were gone. We kept less than 60% of the value chain in-house. In the last 3 years, we moved it to 70, and we're going to move it to 80 or 82% in the next 3. That is not linked to market. It's just linked to levers that you have, management levers that you have, and we will be announcing a number of things, as we have in the past, that contribute to that direction. The second one is insurance. Again, $400 million of increase. This comes from a market rebound, unit-linked, et cetera, same thing as asset management, and then a continued acceleration in what in Italy we call protection, but it's non-life insurance, effectively. And before 21, we had our non-life insurance was CPI alone, and in spite of what the market I don't think is seeing is that our non-life has had the headwind on the loan going down because CPI is sold on mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. If your volumes go down, you sell less CPI. But what you have not seen is that we have had 50-60% growth in non-CPI, non-life, which is health, house, home content, travel, all of this stuff. And in there, we now have about 15% market share on new business, and the network has completely tilted and is going to do that. So that for us is a continued acceleration in protection, which is management levers, and the internalization of unit linked, which will occur probably in 2025, and that will bring significantly more income, and again, not market dependent. Then you move down to payments. Payments, we have less granularity at the moment. We will give you more granularity in Q1. But fundamentally, we expect to grab $300 million. And that is two levers. The market is becoming more and more, let's say, electronic or payment-driven. And the second thing is, again, we're taking with payments the same approach we're taking with asset management across the value chain. The agreement with MasterCards is several tens of millions of advantage. There are other agreements with other providers that we have, and therefore we are re-internalizing pieces, and we're quite confident on that. And then the last one is what we call corporate solution, and it's the combination from all the hedges on FX rates and commodities we give on the payments between providers and users between our markets, effectively, and then advisory and capital markets, where we have spent significant money rebuilding our franchise. If you see the league tables, we are progressing, but it's very, very targeted on our own clients, primarily mid-caps, because that's where we think we have a difference. So all of that together is $1.4 billion or above, and that is what we think will complement some of the compression above.
The path ahead. So I want to change subjects a little bit, because I personally think that it's always very interesting to hear you talk about net revenues, not only thinking about NII isolated, but encompassing that within the context of the cost of risk. So asset quality for UniCredit in the past was a vulnerability, as you highlighted at the beginning. Now it is a strength. I want to understand, is this an underlying change that is sustainable through time, and how specifically did you get there?
So I think it is sustainable through time. I think it's a result of a number of things. Part is actually common to Europeans. Part is very idiosyncratic to UniCredit. Common to Europeans, Europe has not grown in the last decade, and therefore you haven't had expansion of credit and people have cleaned up their portfolio in general. In particular, UniCredit has had a number of problems, and therefore our cleanup has been quite draconian. And it has been accelerated in the 5 or 6 years before I arrived. After I took over, we continued because we viewed in that a core competency or a real competitive advantage on average. So what have we done? Well, fundamentally, number one, we have continued cleaning up our portfolio, selling down exposures, but more important, being very disciplined on the new underwriting. We have tilted the metrics in as much as in the past there was just risk. We are not going to underwrite anything that is above a certain tolerance of risk. From 2021 onward, it is risk and return. So we're not going to underwrite anything that is not at a certain level of risk, but the returns needs to be above the cost of equity, fully loaded. And therefore, we have improved the quality of that portfolio. We have also, in the years of, let's call it, tailwind of rates, we have strengthened our provisions. I mean, we started with less than 900 million in overlays. We now have 1.8 billion. And if you take EBA numbers, country by country, Italy, Germany, Austria, all the way down into CE, and you look at the average of the market, we run, on average, 1.5 to 1.8 billion of provision, more than the market, on a portfolio that I think is better. So why that? Why? Because we think, and I continue to think, that NII can be a very quality source of revenue, but only if, adjusted for risk, it exceeds the cost of equity and it's sustainable and non-volatile. And I think that's what we have worked to do, and I think at the moment we're going to reap the benefit. If you look at our last 2 years, so 8 quarters, and you eliminate from the numbers Russia and the boost of overlays that we have wanted to do, our cost of risk has been very stable around 11 basis points. We're guiding to 20 to 25 with the benefit of releasing overlays to keep it there. So if there is something on risk in the next 24 months, is risk on the upside, i.e. that the cost of risk is lower than what we have in the plan, not higher.
Right. Now, if we think more broadly at the European banking sector, we have been seeing the benefits, as you said, of higher rates. Even if we potentially see rate cuts, we're all expecting to remain within a positive rate territory. How are you thinking, or how would you think about the European banking sector now?
Well, I think that what we miss sometimes is that if you take the last 10, 15 years, European banks have had to live with two things that have changed. One, negative rates. If you're a lender, anywhere between, if you're really one of the best ones, 60%, and 80% of your top line is NII. Try and make money with negative rates. But we don't have negative rates anymore. We have positive rates. Yes, we've gone through a peak, and we're going to stabilize lower. But the lower, if you forget the peak, and you had asked anyone, would you settle with 2 to 2.5% rates as a base, neutral rates rather than minus 50 basis points 3 years ago? In this room, what would have been your answer? A dream. It's not going to happen. That's the first thing. That's why the profitability has lagged, and that is structural. I don't think Europe will go to negative rates, especially with the inflationary pressures that we have from geopolitics and everything else. So that's here to stay. The second thing is we started with not enough capital and a loan portfolio that was lower quality than it should have been. all of us. Different ways, but all of us. In 10 years, we've had not very much growth and all the time in the world to address the quality of our portfolios. That does not mean we're perfect, but it does mean that a lot of banks have worked very hard at improving that. And therefore, vis-a-vis, for example, U.S. banks who have grown, it's more likely than not that we have older vintages, more cleaned up, et cetera, because we have not grown. We have clean. And capital has accumulated. So I do think that that determines, in my opinion, that the European banking sector, in my belief, will bridge the gap of valuation with the Americans, because the macro and what is around it is going to be more similar. The only thing where I do think that the U.S. are ahead is that structural economic growth for the U.S. is greater, so they may be able to deliver more. And secondly, that depending on how the regulation is applied, they may be more flexible than the Europeans. But on the other hand, the Europeans start from being, in my opinion, more efficient, more clean, and more diversified away from NII, because we've had 10 years to having to do that to survive.
You've talked about a topic that we have been wondering about, excess capital, and particularly at UniCredit. It offers a lot of optionality and that firepower potential. In the press, we've been recently reading headlines on Generali and Sondrio. Can you remind us, how are you thinking about M&A opportunities for UniCredit?
Look, at the moment, let's go back to the origin. All the distributions that we have, and that incidentally we feel are only ordinary, and that incidentally we think are sustainable. Sustainable means that we will try to do everything we can to keep them where they are or increase them. That's ordinary. That's linked to net profit and organic capital generation. What we never talked about is the excess capital, or we do, but we leave it on the side. And so how do we look at that? Well, you start with, you can look at our excess capital in a variety of ways. Pre-Bal 4, 9, 10 billion. Post-Bal 4, 6, 7 billion. That is excluding the effect from the extra provisions that will generate capital when it's released. Okay? So when you look at all of that, where does it go? And I was very clear that in the last 3 years, I think we have paid plenty to shareholders, and it didn't make sense to double up or double down with distribution of excess. But now we have it. And our view is it will go back to shareholders in the following way. Personally, if I can deploy it in acquisitions that where we can demonstrate that they have a strategic fit with our model, that we have credibility on integration and on the synergies that we can do, and I think that the team deserves that credibility today, and that deliver at least a 15% IRR, adjusted for all the risk that we usually adjust, then I think we should deploy through acquisition. But when people tell me, oh, it's strategic, yeah, great, it's strategic. If it's strategic at a 5% IRR, forget it. If it's strategic at a 17% IRR, let's talk about it. So we're very disciplined on that, and we will not deviate, even if some people think that we should lower the bar. The only way we lower the bar is if the cost of equity for banks lowers, and at the moment, it doesn't. So that's how we look at them. That would be the priority, but we've looked at a lot of things. Because we look at a lot of things, there is a lot of noise. But now it should also indicate to you that unless we hit what we want to hit, we're not going to deploy. And a lot of people are going to wait for that speculative move, and they're going to be very disappointed. Alternatively, and we haven't really talked about distribution, but we have, as we have discussed, what we believe is a sustainable level of net profit, an organic capital generation that will exceed the net profit, a return on tangible that we are determined to keep above 15%, that generates ordinary distribution that we should be able to hold in line. And then if we cannot deploy the capital, My recommendation, which needs to be accepted to my board or my new board, if we get voted, is that in the next 3 to 5 years, if we can't deploy, we return. And if you take that number, that means that on ordinary distribution, you need to pile on 1.5 to 2 billion a year if we don't deploy in M&A, which takes the distribution level to another level. But if you ask me, I would be disappointed to be there because it means I haven't found profitable ways to invest in the business. And most probably it will be a balance of the two.
We've talked about the journey that has led you here and all of the improvements. Within that journey, we've seen the market capitalization of UniCredit triple. You still say that the company is undervalued. Where or why do you see that there's still upside to be taken?
So put in a simple way, all that you have seen is a deliver of base, so more net profit, with a derating of a stock. And I think if I look forward and I forget where we are, let's suppose this is UniCredit 2.0 and we look forward, which is how I look at it. What is in the next 3 years? What do I see? I see double-digit EPS and DPS growth. Very few people have that, especially in banking. I see return on tangible equity at 15% or above, deliverable. I see net profit that, according to guidance, is broadly in line, that the management team will leave no stone unturned to beat or exceed and then build for them in the next 3 years. And then I see a bottom quartile valuation, even before I adjust for the excess capital, because at the moment we're talking about the excess capital. If you do your numbers, it's valued zero. So when I look at all of that, I say, well, number one, we will be able to improve further our profitability because of all that we have invested in the past. But most of it will come through a convergence of multiple, because once we are sustainable, we go through the cycle, we show that what we have done has really transformed the bank over the next few quarters. I think it is not normal that we are valued at a 20%+ cost of equity. And that is where we are. If you think about it, the return on tangible of last year is 16.6%, including the excess capital, well above 20, excluding the excess capital. We're trading at 0.85 a book. It is not consistent, so there is an expectation that we're going to drop, and I think that expectation is wrong, and we're going to prove it wrong.
Okay. Before we open up for Q&A, because I know a lot of people want to ask you so many things, but just before that, can you give us a brief overview of how you see the quarter, Q1 2024?
So let me be maybe very brief. I would say that we have good momentum, continued good momentum, and that based on what I see, I think that our ability to go beyond consensus is confirmed. But we need to see how the whole year goes, not the first quarter.
Of course. Okay, so we're going to open up for questions. I know a lot of you are wanting to ask Mr. Orcel in person, so please.
Hi there, it's Mark from BDL. Just on the distributions, it's very clear, you know, your message on that, and we appreciate it as shareholders, but is there any change in tone from the ECB on the share buyback component, given the new management there? It seemed to be some kind of, some cautionary statements around capital and liquidity coming, in the recent news. Thank you.
Well, look, I think that in general, any regulator is going to be cautionary on distribution. I would be. Secondly, I think that the market is quite convinced that share buyback are viewed more negatively than dividends. Unless there will be a change, and we haven't noticed any change, share buybacks are actually more positive than dividends because share buybacks get approved by the ECB ex ante, not witnessed ex post. So I think they are, in a way, more under the control of the ECB than others, and the ECB go through stress tests to get you that. And finally, I would say maybe it's more of a market view, and maybe I'm a little bit old school, but dividends are sacrosanct. Once you have them there, you're strapped. They need to happen, and you will do everything to keep them there, not to disappoint. Share buyback have a greater level of flexibility if you need to adjust one way or the other. So I do think they are less committing, and that, from a regulatory standpoint, is better, not worse. If you then ask whether I have seen a change in mood, I think we've had this discussion before because there is a lot of noise. I haven't. I mean, I think the ECB has been consistent, and obviously they look at the next 3 years and they say, what about the cycle? What about sustainability or profitability? What about all of these things that are absolutely defensible? But then they look at the excess capital, the sustainability of our profitability, our organic capital generation, and that we are the only bank who has distributed 100% of net profit and under 100 basis points of capital in a year. If you have that, numbers speak for themselves, and it's very difficult to say, well, no, I don't like it, and we don't, in fact.
We had another question, sorry, right here up front.
Well, and one thing that I would add that is important to notice, very different view between ordinary and extraordinary, meaning don't bundle. What the ECB is very focused on is your ordinary capacity, which they want to see recurrent and sustainable. That's one bucket. Then if you're in excess to a target that they feel is correct and you want to pay that extraordinarily, it's on top and it's completely two different channels. So in a way, there is less problem in increasing extraordinary than increasing ordinary. So bear that in mind.
Good morning. Omar Keenan at Caxton. You talked about capturing more of the value chain in the non-net interest income part of the revenues. So I was just curious to hear your thoughts about where you think UniCredit already has the internal capabilities to be able to take those services over from external providers, or where you think those capabilities maybe perhaps need to be acquired via inorganically, and then that becomes a kind of sort of revenue synergy part of the equation. And then if I may, I had a second question. I just wanted really to have some of your thoughts on the regulatory landscape in Europe. It feels we're kind of quite close to the end, but I guess we've got things like the operational framework coming up, and we've seen a few things on systemic buffers and countercyclical buffers. So just curious what you think there. Thank you.
So, okay, so in terms of value chain, let's be clear, and it depends on the segment, right? So if I take asset management, there is no intent to rebuild a factory, so to be a manufacturer of asset management profit. In some small niche, some segments, et cetera, yes. But if you look at us, we're a distributor. We're not a manufacturer. And we will keep it there because I think the game in asset management is size or category killers, and we're neither. Okay? Now, within that, there is one intermediate layer, if you want. And that intermediate layer is having a team that is capable of selection, aligning the strategies to what our asset allocation team advises, packaging products, wrapping products together, and then some small niche products like the one that we want to do with Azimut, for example. So for me, capturing value chain there means before I was a pass-through with nothing in the middle, you select, you get. Now I have a brain in the middle, and that brain charges money because as you wrap, as you structure, as you select, as you negotiate the contracts, you grab something that you were leaving on the table before. Okay? If I go, but there is no building of an asset management company in today. If you move to insurance, it's a hybrid. On the protection side, so on the non-life side, it's a little bit of that. And more importantly, improving. When I arrived, UniCredit was about, if I want to simplify, lending, investing. Now we're broadening into a number of other things, payments, insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And we have been successful at doing that. So one is the distribution front, which is working very well, i.e. making us capable to leverage our distribution on products we were not distributing before. And there we have been successful. The other thing is on life insurance. And let's define life insurance. Life insurance, UniCredit has 35 to 40% unit-linked market share in Italy. What we bought in Greece, unit-linked market share. What we're looking is unit-linked. And if I may, unit-linked is another way to talk about asset management. So it's an alternative product with an insurance wrapper around, and you move your clients from one to the other depending what the strategy is. So there is very limited insurance in that. Furthermore, we have an insurance company that primarily does unit-linked in Italy, where we are at 49%, that we have a right to buy back. And given the Danish compromise, it's very capital efficient. We will do that in 25. So we will incorporate the know-how. We have a chairman. We have a number of a management team that is from UniCredit. So for us, it's just acquiring what we don't have and consolidating is not something that we don't know. And that will allow us to incorporate the underwriting part of unit-linked that at the moment is external. We have done effectively, or we are doing effectively that with a small acquisition in Greece. That's an acquisition, but it's not very significant in terms of capital deployed because with a Danish compromise, almost nothing. If you move to payment, it depends what you're talking about, right? So if you look at issuing, I look at it as distribution. Maybe I'm wrong, but I look at it as distribution. If you look at acquiring, we would like to boost it just because it allows us to penetrate client segment that we're not in. If you think the micro businesses, if you start having all the payment flows, you can penetrate. If you don't, how are you going to assess their risk? So it has some cross-selling to it. But we have acquiring. We are one of the few banks that have kept acquiring in Italy and in our market in the CEE. And we're going to try to boost that. That you could see some targeted moves on trying to expand that acquiring. But again, small. Don't think it's large things. But it complements our technology and our and what we do in the area. Then you have the two things that have been moving in terms of value chain can move a needle. There is processing that we have fragmented across a variety of providers. Processing is not something where we would ever have, where it's difficult to have a competitive advantage because it's technology and it's volume. But you can discuss with your provider or consolidate your provider or do all that we have done, for example, with other provider and get better terms, better technology, better this and better that. That gets you value chain because you leave on the table less. What we did with MasterCard, we leave on the table a lot less because just think about it. The tradition in Europe was all the credit card or debit card are Visa, MasterCard, Maestro, Giro, Bancomat. So you have multiple branding on that. Now think if you go to one, in our case MasterCard, and you say, all my cards are going to be MasterCard. No more Visa, no more Giro, no more Maestro, no more Bancomat, no more nothing. Only MasterCard. You're going to have critical mass in one shot in 13 markets. That creates a partnership and an ability to negotiate terms, which are, by the way, negative fees at the moment. Like processing fees are negative fees. They're not in the cost line. They're in the negative fees that expand what we can do in the value chain. If you then go to corporate solution, the only one that I would think is advisory and capital market, that if you want, we internalize. We hired the people from a variety of investment banks. We targeted on our 15 million, on our corporate clients. The focus is really mid-caps, SMEs, where we have a very strong presence. Margins are greater. The large investment bank don't reach, and the retail player in all of our market don't have the capability. That's where we penetrate. We build up credibility. We move to the higher level in our markets. We're not going to the U.S. We're not going elsewhere. We're focusing where we are, and I think we can extract a lot of value from that. That we have, in a way, internalized the skill set. Oh, the other one you asked, there was a...
Regulation.
Look, regulation, I think we need to also be clear on one. So first of all, we are at the back end, or at least that's what all we feel, and I have no reason to feel otherwise. But we also need to understand mandates. The mandate of the ECB is solely one, reduce risk. The mandate of the Fed is two, balance economic growth with risk. And in this country, when it was part of the EU, it was only risk, and they changed to economic growth and risk. So there is obviously a bias on risk because that's their mission. But I do think that if you listen while being regulators, they do recognize that there has been a lot of progress. And I do think that that progress is recognized. Now, if you look at some of the new buffers that are being that are being introduced in some countries, Italy is one of them. Yeah, it is a new buffer. But with 650 basis points of MDA buffer that we have, I mean, I would never go to that low anyway, because nobody's running at bonds, or very few are running at bonds. Usually you have a buffer, and this buffer, in a way, fill that gap for the people who are lowering capital. But for us, we're not even looking at that because it's so far away.
I want to pick up on that before we close, because we've talked about the optionality and the shareholder, the potential shareholder distribution with that excess capital. But how are you thinking about the mix of the cash component versus the buybacks now? Is there a multiple, a valuation multiple that would discourage you from doing more buybacks?
So my premise is at some point you need to build the business, so M&A at the right price is better. But if you are now in the scenario where there isn't any and let's deploy, I think it's a balance, and it depends. Number one, do we see significant value in our shares? So I know that a lot of people have a view that when you go above one-time book, you're done. Yeah. No more share buyback. I partially disagree with that view. It's obvious that below book, it's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. The tangible book for share, everything expands, no-brainer. When you're at book, then in my opinion, but it's my opinion and shareholders guide my distribution, it depends. Because if you're running, let's take just a round number, at 20% return on equity and your cost of equity is 10 and you're trading at one-time book, are you buying? I'm buying. Because I should be running at 1.5, 1.6, 1.7. So I'm buying. If I am at 0.85 of book and I'm running at 8% return on equity, maybe I'm giving dividends. So I do think that there is an element of value in there. With respect to where we go, we've already made a step. We used to be 35% cash dividends on net profit before paying 81 in cashes. That is about 500 million. We moved to before.
Yeah.
So now we added effectively 150 million in our cash yield. We indicated that for 2024, we're going to 40. So we've already made the step because we're maturing as a company, and I do think it's the right thing to do. But where are we going to land? I will make two comments. One, my view, completely dependent on what shareholders want. At the end of the day, I need to distribute it back. Within a judgment call, if I have most long-only shareholders that are only yield-sensitive and they want cash, 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 I will obviously tilt. And if instead I have people who say, are you crazy? At that value, buy your shares every day of the week. I'll buy shares every day of the week. At the moment, the balance has been a lot more on buy shares every day of the week because of the gap between perceived value and where we trade. And we'll see where we go. But I think it's a journey. What I would say, the last thing that I would say, there is always a caution because extremes are never good. There is a point where if you commit to a cash yield that is too high, you're strapped. Because, as I said, it's sacred. So once you say, I'm going to distribute X in terms of payout, and you saw what you distributed last year, there is an incredible amount of pressure on management to keep it there.
The expectation.
And that, I think, sometimes start affecting your strategy, your behaviors, and what you do. So in my view, a more balanced between share buybacks and dividend to have more flexibility and more adjustment capacity is the right thing to do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrea.
This was
very, very interesting. Thank you very much for joining us. And have a great day.
Thank you.